By the recording and also for me to set the levels.
Yes, my name is Nomeda.
Nomeda
Gediminas.
I'm gonna have to say Nomeda Gediminas.
Gediminas. Urbanas.
Yes. I won't even pronounce the second name.
It's okay. It's our surname, and also I use it as an artistic name, and it's not that bad because originally my surname is Urbonienie.
Urbonienie.
Urbonienie. And his surname is Urbanas.
Urbona.
And Urbonieni means that I'm also married to him.
Well, that's excellent. That's ruined my evening. So, no, that's a joke. Sorry, English joke, you know,
very
seaside
nice.
Town. No. So, you're going to have to just do it again. Just say your names again, your full name.
My name is Nomeda.
Gediminas.
I'm here with Nomeda and Gediminas in Folkestone at the Triennial. And we're here to talk about, well, I think it's a fantastic innovation that you've done here, because it not only relates to the site itself and this lamppost, but also to science. So first of all, I want to talk about, how did you identify where you were going to make your work?
That's a very good question. And we spent some time in Folkestone, like we came here for a couple of times, of course looking, you know, at places and wandering around and trying to feel, you know, the location for the work, and first maybe even trying to find the interesting place, you know, which would somehow make sense. And this particular one actually we spotted through the window of Googies. Googies is a very energizing, you know, nice place. And we met this wonderful woman called
Stephanie,
who actually spoke about energy. And we looked through the window of Googies and we saw the lamppost. And the lamp was shining, I think, at that time.
Yeah, in the middle of the day, yes.
And then we were kind of told this amazing story about the lamp and, you know, energy and Stephanie, so everything came together. And we said, like, this is perhaps the right spot for the work. And also it is important because it used to be a market square or marketplace in Asian times. So somehow now it felt like it was not so active, or at least like 2 years ago when we came for the first time. So we thought, okay, this is interesting. And it's behind the town hall, another kind of, you know, important place for the power, not only energy.
That's where energies are being negotiated, right?
Exactly.
And policies are being made about energy. And and I think being in this close proximity to power, our work is in a way insist on the alternatives, insist on seizing the power, and insist on engaging the new emerging field of energy humanities.
What I found fascinating was you managed to identify an area that's kind of touches on different councils. And of course in England, the council, you know, the council provide money for this and energy for that. And of course the light comes on because of the building owned by the council, but the land it sits on is another council. I mean, you couldn't have chosen a more interesting site to put the work. But also, this is living art. This is science and art, a marriage of science and art together. And I wanted to talk about that because that is so compelling, because it's also teaching people about future energy. So how did the idea of the lamp and then powering it, how did those clicks happen in your minds to make the work?
You know, it's really funny, but we were at the Museum of Science in Boston, and that museum has amazing piece by Eames, which is called Mathematica Room. And within this Mathematica Room, there is a lovely model that is called Drunken Walk. That shows the lamppost.
Very similar, actually. In the model, the lamp is almost identical to the one, you know, which we have here in Folkestone.
And the path, a supposedly drunken person would walk around the lamppost, making this incredible pattern. And from the scientific perspective, this sort of like drunken walk, or scientifically called random walk, is being studied by the different scientists, and is being also deployed even in the nuclear reactors. So we got inspired by this model, and then we contacted Kent University scientists. As there is a very interesting group of the fungi researchers. Suddenly, how come that at Kent there is this amazing group that brings international scholars from all over the world? You know, we met American scientists who came specifically to Kent because of their reputation in the fungi research.
Mm-hmm. One detail, the American scientist is also of Lithuanian origin.
Well, that's a rather important detail, isn't it?
That's a random word. Well, you know, of course, for the last couple of years, we really obsessed about mushrooms, about fungi, about mycelium. And a few reasons is, of course, books published and written by Anna Zink. Paul Stamets. Paul Stamets. So Paul Stamets has been really trying to sort of advocate for mushrooms as least researched species, so to speak. And sort of like suggesting that least research territory could be very fruitful for humans to engage addressing current issues, current problems. So we found this very interesting connection between the fungi research group and the research group that is engaging the innovation within the battery production and battery science. Within this discussion, you know, we as an artist came talking with scientists from the fungi group and talking with scientists in the battery production and the battery research, in fact, people who are pushing battery innovation. And then Nomeda, you brought some scientific articles, I think, to the table.
Yes, sure. About, you know, this particular research using fungus of fungi in the battery, you know, production.
Because apparently carbonized mushrooms could replace graphene or graphite that is used in the lithium ion batteries. As we know that market has today huge demands for the batteries. You know, we have Tesla, we have all other automobile companies. I think Jaguar has quite also cutting edge research that pushes that frontier. So we have huge demands coming from the industry on one hand. On the other hand, 6.5% of the GDP in the first world countries, you know, developed countries like China and Russia and US and Britain, is spent to subsidize fossil fuel. So the near future definitely will have to reorient to non-fossil fuel direction, and we as an artist, of course, we're thinking, okay, how that could be approached through the from the artistic perspective, and what could also come in with the question, what could be artist's role in this, right? So we have engineers, we have scientists coping with this like enormous questions, almost of non-human proportion, right? But not to have artistic dimension, you know, negotiating these borders. I think is not really giving the sort of like, it's not really addressing fully, you know, the complexities, because the world is, these problems are so complex, right? So, you know, eliminating aesthetic dimension or eliminating the thinking that comes from the artistic point of view, would be reducing complexities just to sort of like domain of economy, right? So so we wanted to sort of like bring what we call artistic intelligence to the game. We're talking about artificial intelligence. I think we want to replace that with artistic intelligence, AI. And we got somehow, we got scientists so enthusiastically on board of this project. So now they are even, well, they're thinking of, they're working, not even thinking, they're working on writing the academic paper. And the battery that they were experimenting with here in, at Kent University, and the battery that is being now deployed in Folkestone Power Plant, which is the rock that's sited next to the town hall. And they wanted to have this title Power Plant because I think it's also today, as people who are coming from humanities, I think we should claim back. We should claim back industrial infrastructures. First of all, we should claim infrastructure, you know, as such. And this is what we try to do as an artist. We try to think what architecture, how we can think about architecture of the infrastructure. You know, how we can think of the. And in this case, architecture is scientific architecture. So the rock is functioning as a lab, and there is and what we are enjoying and what we are proposing also to the viewers and to the scientists and to our collaborators is this proximity between the skin of the rock and this object, you know, what we can call also intermediary object, right, which is the battery.
But also all the relationships between people involved, absolutely. Gerbinas mentioned the scientists at Kent University, but also you know, the project manager, Naomi, who was like very instrumental and crucial in this point, you know, like communicating between us and scientists and finding, you know, the right spots and thoughts.
And what I love about it as well is this, you go into this kind of cave, you know, kind of enter this dark space, and here you've got this rock, and then you go in, and then inside is this little object that's being powered by the carbonized mushrooms that should, of course, be lighting up the lamppost at night. But of course, like any great ideas, and that's what I love about it in a way, is an idea in progress. It hasn't quite made enough energy because I don't think you've been, it's still in progress, so it's not quite been able to light up the lamppost at the moment, but, you know, it's having to use a different power source. But I love that as well, the kind of underlying ironies of any artwork in progress or any scientific experiment is about actually you go by failure. And so I find that very interesting, and it's very much, I think, part of the artistic process.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I wanted to draw you back to the rock itself. And, you know, when you first start working on things, do you do lots of sketches? Do you kind of go, okay, I'm going to draw a rock? And then, because you collaborate, and does one of you say, no, I don't like the look of that, I think it should be something else? How do you, you know, how does a collaboration work between the two of you?
Oh, wow, that's a gen question. It's very challenging, and but we even, you know, even with that, we are not satisfied, so we involve other people to collaborate with, and actually including even the design, you know, when it comes to the design. And of course, in this case of the rock, it was fabulous because, you know, I was the one who did some sketches, and then the sketches were passed, you know, to architects, and they were kind of adjusting the sizes and scales to the actual site and the map, or like very detailed map of the site, which is as you said, very contested site, goes through many, many councils. So, you know, during the process of drawing, we had to come up with the, we had to get the right maps, which was like, you know, really.
That must have been quite challenging as well, yes. Oh, that's another council deals with that,
yeah.
Yes. We don't have the electrical wiring, it's another council.
No, but actually it's kind of paradoxical because it's very central part of the town, yeah, and an old part of the town, and marketplace is like a very historical, you know, place, but they didn't have a precise map of this place. So I think just because of our project and our insistence on that spot, they had to make a map, a proper map. So yeah, we went through all the stages, and then of course the architects, when they were trying to fit this particular spot, because we had like many other visions before and really wanted to engage in the stairs and things, but you know, there were many, you know, limits to what we have to, like, you know, limit ourselves, and restrictions, of course. So this was the only spot where we could like place the thing, just because of the, you know, all the regulations of the site. So of course the shape and, you know, the size, and was sort of like, you know, in discussion. And as we say, like, this is a particular space and particular size because of the actually fossil fuel, thinking of fossil fuel, of how much of the fossil fuel we would need to power that lamp. So there is a certain calculation.
Yeah, thinking of extraction, but I think the very idea of the rock actually comes from our first intuition. You know, when we came here, we started to think of the mountain of knowledge, you know, and what kind of niche we are carving within the mountain of knowledge, right? You know, so there is always the question, what is artistic research, what is artistic intelligence, is it a knowledge production, or it is a different way of thinking of knowledge, you know, or it is like something that destabilizes knowledge, you know. So coming from this perspective that we're carving the niche in the mountain of knowledge, we started to look at the different models of mountains. And we got really fascinated by Humboldt, Alexander Humboldt drawings of mountains as the very essential and fundamental ecologists, right? So
systems of ecology, yeah.
Systems, yeah, we can call ecosystems, right? You know, ecosystems that look into connections and relationships between the things, right? So in this case, thinking of this rock.
Sorry, I'm going to close the window.
Yeah.
The only reason is there are children screaming, and and what happens is it will pick it up. And the one thing that is really weird on recordings is that certain sounds, a lorry or something is fine, or a rumble, but a child's scream, it actually alarms people. That's a child being murdered in the background. No, I'm joking. But you know what I mean. Sorry, you were just saying.
Yeah.
So if we take it, you were talking about Humboldt and the whole systems, etc. So let's go back just to that.
Right. So we're looking at the drawings of Alexander Humboldt, and those were the mountain in Peru that he was drafting, and addressing the relationships to the things that can not only that are found on the mountain, right, but things that can be imagined within the mountain. You know? So he was, as he was like drafting, he was imagining the ecosystematic relationships. And that leads to another thought that we are fascinated very much in our research and our work, is to really think about symbiopoetic relations between the things. So that led us to think of the Folkestone as being this envelope being sort of the host for the mushroom, right? And thinking, you know, the mushrooms is growing in the mountains, but also thinking that the niche that you're carving in this mountain of knowledge, poetically thinking, right, or metaphorically, could sort of like become this sort of like territory where the scientific exploration of the material research, as we're working with material scientists in Kent University, could be somehow connected with the metaphors and poetic thinking within the field of art, you know. So, so on the one hand, we can say yes, we do have scientific breakthrough making these batteries 3 times more powerful than the conventional batteries that are made by using toxic materials such as graphene. But on the other hand, I think it's not only the engineering or sort of like scientific proof is valid here, but precisely as you pointed, this sort of like unfinishedness of the work, right? You know, that, that leaves the territory for imagination.
The other thing is, I believe they can be recharged over 100 times,
yeah.
Which, you know, the whole mythology of a rechargeable battery, you keep recharging it and after a while it doesn't recharge anymore. So I loved this idea of recharging as a metaphor for a town that has recharged itself, that was a port, that was a harbour actually, and a port for ferries, that then lost a lot of business when Eurostar was built, and is now kind of connected because of the high-speed link, but also has been re-energized. So there's a, there seemed to be, to me, a wonderful kind of energy fault line running through your work in terms of how you were like a divining rod, finding these special places here to examine. Can I ask you a little bit about your own practice of collaboration and why you decided to become artists? What was it? How did you meet? How did you decide to work together? Because it's always quite difficult collaborating, I would imagine.
Yeah, we are somehow like, you know, not avoiding, but like running away from this question, like getting to some other, you know, aspects of the work and of the practice. But yeah, actually, I think, you know, we are that generation, at least when we started, you know, to be engaged in that. I started very early, when I was like 7 years old, because of course my parents, they brought me to the art school, to the actually primary school, which already had a focus on arts when I was 7 years old. And then both of us, we went to the special art gymnasium at the age of 10.
Which is amazing. I mean, what an opportunity, fantastic.
Yeah, welcome to Soviet world.
Yeah, sorry, well, yeah, okay. But however, that there were some amazing aspects.
Well, but also, if you look actually at the attitude and approach and support to the social welfare, right, to the social questions and issues, definitely 70s and 80s, I think it was like quite, I think also in Britain before Thatcher, right? Like so there were like really interesting proximities in the 70s, right? Between even like confronting ideologies and confronting states, you know, competing like United States, Soviet Union, Britain. We went to the Soviet art school.
Is that where you met?
No. This was still at you know, high school, sort of like a regular high school combined with the art school. So we would spend the whole day at school and, you know, learn different subjects, but also like lots of art subjects. So we were profiled from the very early stage of our lives, and in a way, you know, once you graduate from such a school, what else could you do? You know, just basically nothing. So we got into the art academy, which was very, you know, competitive at that time and difficult to get in. But you know, we were very gifted already and very talented and very good students, so we got in, and that's where we met.
But then also changes happened, political, economic changes, Soviet planning based system was replaced by the prosperity of the coming capitalism and neoliberal capitalism, and I think that's when sort of like collectiveness, you know, the idea of the collective was detested, you know. So I think I think at that time we got really interested in participatory and collective production, you know, precisely because we were coming from the society that was understood as very much based on the collective production. But it was not, because it wasn't the collective that it was organized from the bottom up. It was the collective that was sort of like repressed. It was organized from the top down.
Yes, but if you also look at the arts, like historical, you know, situation, we were rebellious and rebellious against the modernist, you know, artist genius, which usually would be like a single one man, you know, who has a signature. Yeah, so this was like a protest in a way at that time, you know, to do something together where, you know, you merge the, you know, authorships between two or many.
Right, and you also start negotiating borders, you know, like, so it is about like sort of like questioning and detesting identities as well, and also thinking of new hybridities, you know, what could be these new hybrid collectives. And I think at that time we were so much fascinated in this idea of hybridity, so we established artist-run platform, and we connected with other artist-run platforms. And at that time we connected in Britain with Beaconsfield. This was 95, and we were organizing and curating the first Lithuanian-British exchange that is called Ground Control, that took place in 97.
Which was kind of a breakthrough for the, you know, other type of art, at least in Lithuania.
Yeah.
Well, Beaconsfield was really important in terms of those projects and in terms of, as you say, a kind of collaboration with other places, with other artists, with other thinking, and they were always very interested in kind of the hybridity of different people with different skills working together and kind of coming together and making something kind of extraordinary in the space. It was a very interesting time, I think. But Folkestone itself, and I think the project, really, because you can take the project as just someone wandering around, you can understand it. Here's a wire leading into a lamppost. You can go in, someone will explain to you about the energy. But also, it also makes you learn. And I think that's really important and links with people like Bob and Roberta Smith's work, where he's talking about how, you know, Folkestone itself is a learning hub, if you like, and what is the responsibilities of art in the 21st century. So I wanted to ask you as well about, were there any issues for you when you were making the work? Did you have to make any compromises, or did you suddenly have a night when you woke up and went, oh God, I wish I'd done something really simpler than this?
Many issues and many compromises, a lot, like really a lot. But we would never think, at least me, I would never think what I would like to do something else. But yeah, I think that's like the direct question, answer to your question. But definitely many compromises. And yeah, I think, you know, that's also partly what we are interested in these negotiations and how we can, you know, take it further. So we are not stubborn to one single vision, what we have, but we have to adjust every day to the new situation and, you know, evaluate what was good and what was not working.
With the actual materials you use for the cave itself, or the site itself, the rock, the hub, the energy hub, did you have some decisions there of what you would make it in, you know, what kind of skin that you would use for the actual work?
Oh yeah, we did a lot of computer renderings, and we even tried to kind of, as we're working at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, we actually approached our colleagues, architects, and we were looking into the sort of low carbon technologies to make the skin. So we are looking into what is most advanced, what is most innovative, and whether we can even push the material itself that we are using the skin. You know, sort of like thinking of this reciprocal relationship between you know, the battery thinking and the kind of like, you know, and the material thinking around the battery, right? So. So for us that was in the core, and that's why this model of the random walk, of the drunken work, it's like, you know, was sort of like almost like as the epistem, kind of like that was a driving force, you know, for the whole process. So we did a lot of renderings, but again, as Namer is saying, our sort of like artistic thinking and the way how flexible you have to be within the contested territory where all these negotiations are happening, we had to come up with a very fast decision how to sort of like transform, you know, like one level to another level, you know, like we entering the territory where there are free councils, right? Like, you know, that's what is decided, you know. So again, to get permissions, but also to make compromises, right? Like to translate from something that maybe you initially think and you desire, you consider, into something that is permitted and that is possible and that is maybe safe, you know, and that is accessible and that is feasible.
Like just simply, like, you know, the budget allows to do that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Many things.
Well, I didn't ask you about budget, but of course there is always a budget,
yeah.
Of course, and that's,
yeah.
You know, it's part of a triennial, and it's a part of a lot of other artworks as well. And I think sometimes it's not quite appreciated how many different layers there are, from health and safety to the siting of the work to the administration to
yeah.
permissions to short-term loans of things, and you know, all these things all need a form, all need to be signed off, and someone is sitting there kind of having to do that, you know.
even such a you know, kind of contradictory thing, like for example batteries, which are, like, you know, still in the process of being invented, created,
mm.
Yeah, so they are not like finally, you know, approved by those who will put them into the market, yeah. So, and we have a public site where people, like, this is like a public site where people have to be safe, and batteries are, like, you know,
mm.
these kind of like elements which might be dangerous. So we are like really contradicting this, because on one hand we want this invention and something very, very fresh and new, and on the other hand it has to be approved by so many, you know, like councils, yeah, and it should be safe for people to like be in the proximity, you know.
No, because we have the precedents, like we have the stories of batteries being
no.
burnt in the cell phones, right?
Or people
so
being like burnt, you know,
yeah.
just like by answering the phone. So.
So we would, of course, we would not like that thing to happen, you know, in the in this wonderful Humboldt Mountain, right?
What is the future for the work? Obviously, as you've already very eloquently said, it is a work in progress. It doesn't quite power the lamp yet, because there are not 60, they're still being manufactured.
Yeah.
Do you envisage lots of these caves springing up, and, you know, the next time they power, I don't know, 4 lampposts, the next time a whole city, I don't know. You know, do you have some kind of thoughts about this work as a piece that progresses?
Yeah, I think very much we somehow tapped into the territory which is like hot, if you wish. So as we mentioned, we are, you know, organizing this Future Energy Summit, the quite ambitious event on Sunday, with many like very interesting speakers coming to Folkestone. And it's been, like, you know, advertised around, and not only locally but also internationally, and we got like very, you know, positive feedback from like people all over the world. And
it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
You know, people are writing us from Korea, from Russia,
mm-hmm.
from
Belgium,
from France,
yeah.
from United
Italy.
States.
That's amazing. I mean, it shows the power of art and science to actually galvanize thought, you know, in the, you know, and I was thinking today about experiments in art and thinking right back to Leonardo and then kind of fast forwarding to the wonderful EAT, the EAT experiments,
yeah,
and the wonderful Billy Kluber and his yeah. glorious experiments. And, you know, I think, yes, this kind of feeds into those kind of what if, or, you know, Burden with his aeroplanes that didn't quite fly, but it didn't matter, or his self-navigating boat. You know, I was thinking, yes, that's what, you know, that's interesting.
Amazing. Thank you so much for such a wonderful, you know, trajectory.
From Leonardo to, yeah.
yeah, to the spaceship Earth. But
spaceship Earth. No, but you know what I'm saying,
yeah.
that there is this this interesting, wonderful experiments, you know, with art where, you know, they do make people think about, wow, a mushroom. I would never have thought about mushrooms being able to be a battery before I saw your work. It would never have even, you know, I cook mushrooms a lot, but I wouldn't have thought about it. And I loved that. I really thought, great, that's really interesting. So
yeah,
is your house going to be powered by mushrooms
definitely.
Eventually?
Yes, that's what we need. We had an old solar panel on the roof, which has to be replaced, so definitely, yes.
Mushroom energy.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think, oh, no, there was one last question I wanted to ask, and it's actually about memory. And I wanted to ask both of you individually, what was the first, it may have been an artwork, it may have been music, it may have been a piece of literature that first made the hairs on the back of your neck stand up, or you first thought, oh, that's wonderful or beautiful or changed my life or was interesting? It could have been a building, it
when?
Could have been anything, from a child.
From a child? That's super difficult.
You don't have to answer it, but it's just interesting that sometimes people, you know, there was something they saw as a child or a teenager, or the first time they saw something that kind of made them think about the world a little bit differently, or I don't know, if somebody asked me that question I couldn't answer it, so it's just some people have a moment where they say, oh, I went to the opera, or I saw, you know, Leonardo's drawings or something.
I have one which would be like completely, completely silly, and I struggled with it, you know, during all my life basically, or especially like last 10 years. So I have one, but would you like to answer something?
She's making you go first. She's making you really fight for this one.
Well, I would need to look for the precise title in English, but I remember the lesson in the, I was in the school, and our music teacher played the record of Mussorgsky, the Russian composer, mm-hmm. Of his work called Pictures of Exhibition.
Oh yeah, Pictures in an Exhibition.
Pictures
yes.
in an Exhibition, that's what it's called. Yeah.
Yes.
So I think that had on me a really transformative effect, because I was started to, first of all, the first time, like very, very sort of like clearly and in a very articulate way to think of synesthesia and think of the relationship between, you know, the sounds, something that's tangible, intangible, sounds, colors, three-dimensional spaces. You know, that was like really visceral experience. Like it was so, I never thought sort of like writing or articulating about that, but as you ask now this question, you know, like really, like evoked my memory, you know.
And Jade?
No, I'm trying to remember the first one, so I do remember my first experience of like something exciting, like a catharsis, you know, like when I really like got wow affected by something, and that was like simply Heartbreak Hotel when I was 6 years old. Mm-hmm. I jumped on the table and started to dance, but this was like, you know, the first catharsis which I experienced is, you know, from there something what you could say like this is a pop music or whatever. But and then later, you know, like really another kind of like more conscious, you know, experience, I think it was actually Kashuba, Lithuanian artist who lived in the United States, or who actually lives in the United States. Now she's like older generation, but at that time it was like her projects, what was it, like 80s perhaps,
yeah.
When I saw them.
She was included, she was the only woman who was included in Art and Technology, a show at LACMA, happening in...
71 or 79,
yeah.
Something like that. And I was at school and we had a lecture of the director of the school who visited her in the United States. And at that time it was like deep Soviet Union, maybe 84, 83, something like that, 1983. And yeah, and of course, you know, we were like really, you know, on the other side of the Iron Curtain. So, you know, everything was just kind of, you know, about the, you know, Western culture or like, you know, a different type of art than social realism would be like really far away. And I was like, you know, exposed to that, you know, thing, which was like neither sculpture nor architecture. And I was like really impressed by this, you know, hybridity again of the form.
Well, I think they're both very interesting examples, because one is, well, they're both examples actually. That's very much an example of hybridity. And then synesthesia also is about translating something. I mean, again, it's two different things coming together, you know, sound and colour. And so, great. Well, thank you very much. That was fabulous. I'm stuck to the page now. That's fabulous. And now look at the rain. Oh, my God.
That's Boston. December.